Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. This week, we have an exclusive interview with Carol Mundell about her dual roles as Professor of Extragalactic Astronomy at the University of Bath and Chief Scientific Advisor to the UK's Foreign and Commonwealth Office. That interview is done by my colleague Margaret Harris, who will be here a bit later to talk about some zany ways that physicists have got themselves into heaps of trouble. But first, I'm joined by my colleague Michael Banks to reflect on the prodigious life of the condensed matter physicist Philip Anderson, who died on Sunday at the ripe old age of 96. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Hamish.
Now, Anderson is not a household name outside the world of physics, but he has been described as the world's most creative physicist. So who was Philip Anderson?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Anderson certainly wasn't so much a household name outside of physics, as you say. But I think it's fair to say that Anderson was really a true giant of 20th century physics. He made a number of breakthroughs in so many different areas, especially of condensed matter physics, such as superconductivity and also magnetism. So Anderson was born in 1923 in Indianapolis, in Indiana, and he went to Harvard University to study physics. But that was just before the Second World War, and actually during the Second World War itself, he was drafted into the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory, where he started to work on antenna design. But after the war ended, he then moved back to Harvard, and he started a PhD in physics under the supervision of John Van Fleck. And it was really, you know, during this time that he kind of started to work on these kind of different areas of condensed matter. And he kind of carried that on as well through when he moved into Bell Labs as well. And that's where he did a lot of his most famous research. And one particular area that he kind of did work on and made great breakthroughs was looking at the electronic structure of solids. So we kind of knew at the time that in metals and semiconductors, electrons can kind of travel freely through this kind of periodic crystal lattice. But what Anderson kind of studied then was what would happen if you kind of introduce some kind of disorder into that lattice. And he found out that under some kind of certain conditions, these kind of electrons that moved freely would actually become trapped. So kind of the atoms would kind of trap the electrons. And this was kind of some sort of localization, which then got referred to later on as Anderson localization. And actually, after that discovery, we've seen it in different systems, like in light, in microwaves, and also in atoms that are trapped in Bose-Einstein condensates. So for this work that he did in the electronic structure of atoms, he was awarded the 1977 Nobel Prize, which he shared with the British physicist Neville Mott and also his supervisor, Van Fleck.
And in 1963, Anderson published a paper that essentially described a Higgs-like mechanism. However, he didn't share the 2013 Nobel Prize with François Englert and Peter Higgs. Was that a sore point for Anderson?
Well, yeah, in the 1950s and 60s, Anderson also was working on superconductivity. So these are materials, superconductors, materials that in which the electrons can travel without resistance. So he was applying concepts known as spontaneous symmetry breaking to superconductivity. And he found applying this theory could help to explain how a superconductor expels a magnetic field. So that in itself was kind of great, a breakthrough in some respects. But he also showed how photons in a superconductor could acquire mass. And this actually, the paper that he published in Physical Review about that was then actually cited by Peter Higgs in his now famous paper about a mechanism for understanding the origin of mass. So as a result of that, you know, Anderson came very close to actually kind of discovering that mechanism as Peter Higgs just only a year or two later actually did. And as we all know now, you know, Peter Higgs, through that theory, you know, came the Higgs boson, which was then later discovered at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in 2012. So yeah, kind of. So Anderson, in some sense, did come quite close to that major discovery. But actually, when Higgs was awarded, Higgs and Engler were awarded the Nobel Prize in 2013. I actually was in touch with Anderson, and I asked him, you know, for his views on whether the Swedish Academy made the correct decision, you know, just to stick with Higgs and Engler in that award. And he didn't seem to have, you know, it didn't seem to be a sore point with him there. He actually said that he did think they made the right decision in just awarding it to those two.
And despite the fact that, you know, many of his ideas have been adopted in particle physics, Anderson did have a very fractious relationship with the particle physics community. Why is that?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that Anderson did hold a fairly skeptical view of particle physics. And especially there was some in the field who thought in some sense that it deserved more funding than other areas of physics, especially not Anderson's area of condensed matter. And that kind of bore itself out in some respects in, you know, to his opposition of the superconducting supercollider. And this was a huge 87-kilometer particle collider that was being planned in Texas in the US. And that would have cost around $4 billion at the time. And Anderson famously gave testimony to the US Senate in which he laid out those concerns that the huge costs of building this collider would actually result in cuts to other areas of physics and beyond. And he wasn't really the only physicist who had such concerns. But in some sense, he became this kind of figurehead for that disagreement, you know, where this kind of funding should come from, and somewhat unfairly, it could be said. But he also wrote a famous paper in Science, actually, that was published in Science, where he kind of laid out some kind of philosophical views about our kind of how we approach problems in science. And in that paper, which is entitled "More is Different," it's quite a famous paper now.
It is, yeah, very famous.
But he kind of laid out some of the limitations of reductionism, which was a kind of an approach to problems that was becoming, you know, larger in physics at the time, especially in the particle physics community. And that was to do with kind of showing that problems could be solved by it, that if you knew the fundamental constituents of a system, then you could kind of know everything about it. But in some sense, Anderson kind of disagreed with this, and he was more concerned with an emergent kind of view, and that was saying that if a system actually grows larger, you know, then new phenomena can come out of that. And so that was kind of a huge philosophical disagreement at the time between those different views between reductionism and emergence.
But am I right in thinking, Michael, that particle physicists have embraced this idea of emergence?
Yeah, I think those areas now, well, that kind of thinking is a bit more widespread than what it was kind of at the time, back in the 80s or 90s.
And Anderson was also a friend of Physics World, and you know, you mentioned that you were in contact with him in 2013. What sort of contributions has he made over the years to Physics World?
Yeah, that's one thing is remarkable about Philip Anderson is that, you know, he really was active, you know, until the very end. He wrote a number of reviews for Physics World, and also, you know, from time to time also wrote in letters as well. One of those in particular was about the debate around supersolids and the existence of supersolids. Yeah, and I was also always in contact with him. He was always very kind with his time. You know, whenever there was a kind of a Nobel Prize announcement, you know, I would get in contact with him to see what his views were. And he always, you know, he would always, you know, just write a few sentences, but they're always, you know, kind of, you know, he always got to the point, and they were kind of, you know, very in-depth kind of thoughts that he had. which I then included in some of the stories. And in 2013, he wrote a review for us of a biography of Freeman Dyson, who was a contemporary of his. Anderson was at Princeton University and Freeman Dyson at the Princeton Institute for Advanced Studies.
I mean, one little nugget that I have about Philip Anderson is that, and this is something that I haven't really seen mentioned, in the sort of many articles and blogs that I've read over the last few days, is that just after Brian Josephson predicted the Josephson effect, Anderson and a colleague at Bell Labs did an experiment where they built what I think was the first Josephson junction and actually experimentally confirmed Josephson's prediction. And you can find this in a lovely little paper in Physical Review Letters. Not only was Anderson a great theorist, he was also involved in an experiment that confirmed, a fantastic effect of quantum physics. You seem to have fingers in many, many pies, definitely. You can read more about Philip Anderson in Michael's article, which appears in the news section of Physics World. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Hamish.
With many labs and other facilities shut, and thousands of scientists forced to work at home because of COVID-19, there's a lot of research that just isn't getting done right now, as our ongoing Physics in the Pandemic series shows. But in some fields, remote working and automation were already the norm. A good example is the study of gamma ray bursts, which are the specialty of Carol Mundell, who is a professor of extragalactic astronomy at the University of Bath, here in the UK. Mundell spoke to my colleague Margaret Harris about some recent work on gamma ray bursts by her research group. And Mundell also spoke about her role as chief scientific advisor to the UK's Foreign and Commonwealth Office. Here's that interview.
If you could just begin by reminding our listeners what gamma ray bursts actually are, because this is what you study. This is a really big part of your research, isn't it?
That's right. So gamma ray bursts were originally discovered by military satellites in the late 1960s, early 70s as bright, intense, but very short-lived flashes of high-energy gamma rays on the sky. And we now think that they're produced by the collapse of massive stars, 200 to 300 times the mass of our own sun. They reach the end of their lives, they collapse catastrophically to form a black hole, and in the process, they eject material that if the light is beamed towards us, it then appears as a bright flash on the sky. The other model is when compact objects like neutron stars and black holes merge together, they produce a different kind of gamma ray burst, a much shorter, harder in terms of the radiation mechanisms. And we think that they produce gravitational waves as well. And in fact, we've made great progress in understanding the physics of these extreme objects, literally just in the last couple of years.
And you mentioned that they were originally detected by sort of military satellites. How are they detected nowadays? Because that must have been just chance that the military satellite happened to be looking for something and it saw a gamma ray burst.
That's right. I mean, the military satellites were actually looking for terrestrial flashes of gamma rays that would signal violations of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. And so they were very wide detectors and they could not actually localize where the flashes were coming from. And once the scientists realized that, in fact, they weren't coming from the Earth, they were not man-made, the field didn't really advance for many years because just giving somebody the instruction, something has happened somewhere on the sky, is not adequate for any other telescope to be able to go and look. You need a more accurate localization. So the revolution in the field really came in the early 1990s when a Dutch-Italian satellite called Beppo Sachs was launched. And it was an X-ray satellite. And it made the first discovery of an X-ray afterglow, so a so-called dying ember of the blast that lasted much longer than the few seconds the gamma ray flashes last. And so that localization of the very first gamma ray burst in the X-rays in 1997 was then the key for allowing optical astronomers to slew their telescopes to look for the equivalent in the visible bands. The measurement then of that optical light and ultimately a redshift, which is our measure of distance, then proved that these objects were cosmological and they were not actually occurring inside our own galaxy. And so now we have dedicated satellites, in particular the NASA SWIFT satellite, which was built and launched in 2004 to catch literally on the fly, hence the name SWIFT, gamma ray bursts. It has a wide field detector that can actually look for and catch the gamma rays from these flashes. We don't know where they're going to occur. We don't know when they're going to occur. And so the technology actually finds the gamma ray flashes and is able to localize them sufficiently well to immediately tell optical telescopes where the burst is and start to gather some information on it. And it's really that revolution in technology in the early 2000s that allowed my team, who were working to develop fully robotic autonomous optical telescopes, to be able to develop the camera technology to start to really catch the visible light from these bursts within seconds and minutes rather than the many, many hours that used to be the case when one had to phone up a friend at an observatory and say, this thing occurred, when it gets dark tonight, could you have a look at it for me?
Okay, so what happened in this specific gamma ray burst that you've studied in this recent paper you've just published?
So this burst happened in January 2019. It was a very bright burst, both in terms of its gamma rays, but also in terms of its visible light. So if you had had a small telescope in your back garden and it had been nighttime and you'd known where to look, you would have been able to see the optical light from this burst. The other thing that this burst was very special for observationally was it was the first time scientists had ever detected tera electron volt radiation. So this is very, very high energy gamma rays, and they were detected by large ground-based telescopes called the MAGIC array. So these are really like giant dishes, sort of mirrors, if you like, and they catch the optical flashes that occur when the gamma rays come through the Earth's atmosphere. And so that was what was very, very special about this burst. There are new facilities being built called the Cherenkov Telescope Array, and we've hoped that, and we expect to be able to detect gamma ray bursts with that array when it's built. But until January of last year, that had never been done. And so what happened was there were teams around the world that started to follow up the burst alert. Our telescopes sprung into action. So our optical robotic telescopes, the Liverpool telescope, which is in the Canary Islands, it's a 2-meter aperture optical telescope, fully autonomous and robotic. And also our colleagues' network of small robotic telescopes called the MASTER network, that's led by our Russian colleagues. They sprung into action when they received the discovery trigger from the SWIFT satellite in real time. And we were able to get onto the sky within 30 seconds of that alert coming down. And we started to then monitor the properties of the visible light from the explosion.
And what did you see?
So what we saw was a very bright optical counterpart. As I say, you would be able to have seen it with a small telescope if you'd known where to look and you'd been ready to look. And the light faded. And what we do when we look at the optical light curves, we try to understand some of the physics of the material that's being ejected in the blast. Now, these objects are so far away, they will always be unresolved point sources on the sky. We won't be able to take photographs of their structure. But the way we try to disentangle the physics and the structures of these objects is by looking at how the light behaves, both in terms of its color, how it fades with time, or in fact, in some cases, how it rebrightens in time. And we try to decode all of the physics happening in these distant explosions by looking at the properties of the light. And one of the things that we know is that the material, when it's exploded, it doesn't come out in all directions in the same way. We now understand that the material is focused into a beam of plasma that is ejected from the blast close to the speed of light. And when that beam of plasma points towards the Earth, the light that comes from that plasma is also given a kick because the material is moving very quickly. And when that beam points towards us, it's almost like a laser pointer pointing directly at the Earth. And we know that when the light fades, we can look at how quickly the light fades, and that gives us a direct handle on the shock mechanisms as the material is blasting out from the central black hole engine. There are two kinds of shocks. So the original gamma ray burst is really that the central engine producing its radiation. And as the blast wave moves out and it starts to collide with the external material from the leftover remnants of the star, we see an external shock. This is what produces the afterglow light in the X-ray, the optical and white out into the long wavelength radio waves. And that forward shock, that external shock, consists of two parts, a forward shock and a reverse shock. The forward shock will continue to propagate out into the interstellar medium, and we can actually sometimes see the radiation from that in the radio band for many, many years after the original burst. But the reverse shock propagates back into the oncoming flow, and it's really the last point at which the light that we detect is really giving us a direct probe of that primordial plasma that was ejected out from the formation of the black hole. And what my team specialize in is catching that fast fading early time light from the reverse shock, because it doesn't last very long. It's gone literally in a few minutes after the burst. And using the properties of that reverse light, a special property called polarization, to try to understand the magnetic fields that are threaded through the expanding plasma. As I say, we know by looking at how the light fades that we have collimated ejection, but one of the big theoretical questions that was unanswered was, what was the importance and role of magnetic fields? So these are incredibly powerful explosions. They're the instantaneously most luminous objects in the universe when they erupt. And the theorists were really, they had two competing models. One was a hydrodynamic model, that all of the energy was in the kinetic energy of the material that was kicked out. The competing model was a pointing flux model, so all of the energy density was stored in the magnetic fields. And both of those models have advantages and disadvantages. And so a few years ago, my group decided that we wanted to test which of these models was correct. What you cannot do, though, is distinguish those models by looking at the fade of the light only. The models are degenerate in terms of the light curves. And so what we realized we had to do was measure the polarization. And back in the 1990s, scientists were able to measure the optical polarization of GRBs many, many hours after the explosion. And they found very low levels of polarization, which told them that the magnetic field had either, if there was one in the jet, it had already been destroyed by the time the telescopes were observing, or that the magnetic field, which we know has to be there to produce the light, is actually just a very weak scrambled magnetic field in the external medium, and it gets squished at the time the shock passes through, and that would give very low polarization. So what we realized was, if we could catch the reverse shock light, measure the polarization of that light, we would be able to have the only direct probe of the magnetic field structure at very early time. But to do that, we had to get on very quickly while the reverse shock light was still there, and we had to measure the polarization in real time, and there was no instrument available to do that. So we developed the technology for the Liverpool telescope. We're now on our third generation instrument, Ringo 3 is its name, and it's quite novel, and that was what we used to study this burst, to really pin down what its magnetic field properties were.
And is this the first gamma ray burst that's sort of happened since you had this fantastic new technology to observe things? Is this the sort of the burst you've been waiting for?
So this is not the first burst that we've measured with this technology. We actually caught a burst with a previous generation instrument that was not able to split up the light into colors. We just did this with white light, Ringo 2. And we looked at this burst back in 2012, and we found very high degrees of polarization, so up to 30% polarization. And it also fitted the predictions. It was reverse shock. The reverse shock was very clear from the light profile. And we were very excited, because we'd shown that large-scale ordered magnetic fields in that particular burst appeared to survive long after the explosion. And we've looked at a number of bursts since. The 2019 burst was a big surprise to us, though, because it was so bright. It produced very high energy gamma ray radiation. When we looked at our optical light curves, it was clearly a reverse shock. And so we fully expected, when we looked at our polarization data, to see very high polarization and confirm the model that we had. And we were very surprised when we first started to analyze the Liverpool telescope data, because we found a very low degree of polarization. The measurement was coming out around about 2 to 4%, which is what you expect from late time polarization or forward shocks only. And it was clearly a reverse shock, so we were absolutely confused. When we started to break down some of the light curves and we started to do some detailed analysis, what we realized could have happened was that the large-scale ordered magnetic fields would have been there early on. And if they had actually collapsed and given up their energy, that would have driven the very, very bright afterglow. And all of the timings of that worked very well with the data that we had. So that was our hypothesis. And then we were contacted by our Russian colleagues who had some data that was a little bit earlier in time than the Liverpool telescope. And we were able to use their data to test that idea. And in fact, we caught just the tail end of the magnetic field. So one point a little bit earlier, at 50 seconds after the burst, we measured nearly 8% polarization. And so that confirmed what we then had interpreted the data as, that if we had that large-scale ordered magnetic field, which we know exists in GRBs because we've measured them on previous ones, that actually that would have been very, very short-lived, and it would then have, that collapse of that magnetic field could have released its energy to drive the rest of the afterglow. So it's very exciting when we put all the data together.
This feels like sort of a very pertinent paper for our times at the moment. You know, the data was all collected remotely, and then it was analyzed by this big international consortium of researchers. How do you think this current pandemic situation is going to change things for researchers and for collaborations like yours?
Yeah, I think it is very much a paper that's pertinent for our time. I mean, obviously, we have this, you know, very devastating global health crisis. And I think it's amazing to see scientists working internationally and health scientists and all sorts of international diplomats and bodies working together to try to solve this, this very, very human crisis. I think the work that we've been doing in some ways until now has been very novel and has seemed quite niche. The traditional way astronomers do their science, and as I did when I was a student, you apply for time on a telescope, it's peer reviewed, you win the time, you book your flight, and you travel there to make your observations. Our science, we can't do that because these objects are fleeting and they don't last long enough for us even to, you know, wake up and go out of the door, let alone to get on a flight. And I think our community has been discussing very much about, obviously, climate impact of going to international conferences, of going to do our science somewhere else. Some people have to go to the location to do what they need to do. But the science that we've been trying to do has necessarily driven innovation in the way we do our science. That innovation has made us competitive in being able to answer new physics questions. And I think for me, particularly now with this unprecedented closure of our global international travel networks and countries really looking inward as they try to cope with the crisis that they have within their borders, I think it's been, you know, one really positive thing to know that I can email my international collaborators, some of whom, my co-authors, I've actually not met in person before. We've done this science. We've been able to do something exciting and important in terms of fundamental science, and we haven't had to go to meet one another to do that. And the cooperation has been fantastic as well.
Now, you do have an official role as well as your role as an astrophysicist at the University of Bath. You're the chief scientific advisor in the Foreign Commonwealth Office. What does that role involve in these unusual times? How have you been helping to sort of coordinate the scientific side of the response, not necessarily the medical side, but the scientific side?
Yeah, that's right. So the way science advice to government works in the UK, we have chief scientific advisors in each Whitehall department. The government chief scientific advisor, Sir Patrick Vallance, advises the Prime Minister and Number 10. And we all work together across Whitehall on whatever particular science advice issue happens to be on the table. That might be strategic. In this case, it's emergencies. And so there is a formal grouping called the Science Advice Group, the Science Advice to Government in Emergencies, SAGE. And that group is brought together under the government chief scientific advisor, and in this case, co-chaired with the chief medical officer, Professor Chris Whitty, because of the nature of the crisis. And that group is brought together with relevant people on it to address the evidence base that is needed for the particular emergency. Within the Foreign Office, my role obviously has that CSA role across Whitehall, but particularly in the Foreign Office, my work broadly centers around science diplomacy, and the international science agenda. And in this case, particularly because the crisis began in Wuhan in China, our Foreign Office colleagues were, of course, very much on the ground supporting and helping local efforts. And so it was important that as CSA in the Foreign Office, I was able to act as a bridge for that science advice to make sure that our colleagues had the right science evidence as it was emerging in a very, very difficult and uncertain time, so that they could make the right operational decisions to support our British nationals as they continued with their operations to help them to come home.
And that raises an interesting point. I mean, there's various different scientists from various different backgrounds filling these roles in the various offices within government. You know, what do you think that a physicist, and particularly an astrophysicist, has to sort of contribute in a crisis like this, which does not really involve physics or astrophysics, at least not in the main?
That's right. I mean, I think that the role of chief scientific advisors, you may bring your expertise to a particular topic if you have it, but that's not our primary role. We understand the scientific method. We can translate science into science advice. We can collate and bring different stakeholders' inputs together. And we also are civil servants. So we act as an interface between the sorts of cultures within the civil service. A desk officer may be working at a very different pace to an academic who's working on an academic paper. And I think understanding both of those environments and the different pressures and challenges that those different communities have, the CSAs can act as a bridge or a filter or sometimes a translator. I think of myself, you know, particularly as a translator to help to make sure that all of those communities can communicate in a way that helps us to move forward quickly on the issue that we happen to be tackling. And I think as a physicist, and particularly as an astrophysicist, I've always worked internationally. I haven't worked limited by national borders. And that's particularly important in the Foreign Office around the international science agenda, the kind of diplomatic efforts that we have to mount and to work on, and where science advice sits there and how one can draw on those wider science networks. We have a network of over 110 science and innovation attachés covering over 50 countries who at normal times work within our overseas embassies and high commissions to provide the science advice within our embassies to our ambassadors and make sure that the UK's world leading science reputation is used in those diplomatic forum environments where we need to use the science advice in different ways.
Well, we certainly hope that all that system is working at full, obviously at full capacity right now, and we wish them well in their efforts. Kara Mundell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now I'm joined down the line by Margaret to chat about what we've done this year in lieu of publishing an April Fool's spoof story. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Hamish.
So we've done something a little bit different this year on the 1st of April.
Yeah, Hamish. So in keeping with a long tradition that I think is particularly common with UK-based publications, Physics World usually posts an April Fool's Day story involving some plausible but entirely fake bit of physics news. Last year's story was about someone discovering an error in an official commemorative Stephen Hawking coin. We had a couple that were about sort of Brexit-related projects. One of them in 2017, I think, was supposedly the UK was starting its own geoengineering effort by pumping up particles into the atmosphere from atop the Shard in London. The clue to the fact that that story is fake is that the rival European effort was supposedly called the European Sulfur Particle Environmental Watch, or EuroSPEW, although there have definitely been sillier acronyms out there.
And I think I shouldn't be laughing because I wrote that.
you're allowed to laugh at your own jokes, so it's okay.
And as I recall, I think that was spewing out of the Eiffel Tower, wasn't it? Rather than the Shard.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And in 2016, it was another good one. We had a quantum computer that defeated not a Go master or a chess master, but actually a Jenga master, which I think would be a little bit high level even for the best quantum computers 4 years on. But yeah, I think we decided to do something different this year for the obvious reason that none of us were in a particularly silly mood. We didn't really want to write a story about the coronavirus because, frankly, there is enough misinformation out there without us deliberately adding to it. But by the same token, it would have seemed odd not to. It already feels kind of odd to be writing and editing science stories that aren't about the pandemic, although it is nice to have an escape now and then.
And so what you've done is you've collected some rather silly things that physicists have done. And I think your piece begins with a cautionary tale about those really powerful magnets that you can buy today.
Yeah, so this is actually a story that was reported by the Guardian newspaper earlier this week. It's of a Australian astrophysicist by the name of Daniel Reardon. And he was actually, his heart was so in the right place here. He was trying to invent a device to keep people from touching their faces, which is really important given the coronavirus pandemic. And he had some electronic kit at home, and he was bored. And this is all fine, except somehow, while he was messing around with the kits, he ended up with 4 neodymium magnets stuck up his nose, which he then had to have removed in hospital. You can read the whole story in the Guardian newspaper, and I urge you to do so. I found it a real day brightener, and also full marks to Daniel Riordan for being willing to talk about his own foolishness. You have to kind of run with these things, really.
Yeah, I found that article interesting because a few years ago I bought some of those magnets for a DIY project. They're actually really good for finding studs behind plasterboard because they stick to the screws. They're so powerful.
Just make sure you don't sneeze while you're doing that job, I guess.
Exactly. And the thing is, I remember distinctly on the package, it said very, very clearly, do not ingest. So, it is often the case that that physicists maybe think they're above warnings such as that.
Yeah, well, we thought exactly that. We thought, well, we probably have some more stories like that in our archives of physicists doing stupid things. So we racked our brains and came up with a few.
And there's a really a good one about a fellow Canadian who took a very unconventional take on the ice bucket challenge. What happened there?
Well, the ice bucket challenge, just to remind you of things that happened, you know, 4 years ago, as in before this past March. The ice bucket challenge was the idea that you'd pour a bucket of ice over your head, and you'd do this to raise money for research on motor neurone disease, or ALS, as it's known in the U.S., and a scientist at the University of Toronto in Canada, Mo Qureshi, decided to do this ice bucket challenge, but instead of doing it with ice, he did it with liquid nitrogen.
Ooh.
And yeah, it turns out it's really cold, 77K, really cold. Yeah, he didn't need hospital treatment for it, fortunately, but it's definitely not something you should at all try at home, especially not now during a coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, I was really surprised. Well, obviously really surprised that he did it, but also that he didn't need to be hospitalized. I would have thought that you'd get a really nasty case of frostbite. So maybe he was just lucky. And don't try that at home. And Margaret, there's also a few physicists that you mentioned in your piece who have got themselves into trouble with the law.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that a lot of physicists do illegal things in their spare time, and often these things have nothing to do with their jobs. I mean, every barrel has its bad apples. So you might ask why these stories are on our list, and it's indeed one of our readers actually has on Twitter. But in both cases, I think the stories we've picked are not run-of-the-mill crimes. They're actually pretty spectacular examples of how highly intelligent people can end up doing really massively stupid things. So you'll have to go to the story on the website to find out what they are. But I think you'll appreciate them when you read them.
Yeah, they both are really interesting tales, that's for sure. And finally, there's a fantastic story about a really bad day in the lab. Someone called Kevin McGuigan, I think, got himself into a lot of trouble with a leaking gas bottle and a very strong acid. What happened there?
I think you really should check out the story. This is actually Kevin McGuigan. Again, fair play to him. He told us this story himself. He wrote about it in Physics World's Lateral Thoughts column of humor essays some years ago. And it really needs to be read to be appreciated. But let's just say that it's a day that's convinced everyone involved that McGuigan's theoretical and modeling skills should be enthusiastically encouraged as opposed to his apparently non-existent laboratory skills. So yes.
Yeah, definitely.
Our thanks to Kevin McGuigan for sending us that information. And by the way, you know, I'm sure that, you know, hopefully not everybody has poured a bucket of liquid nitrogen over their head or got in trouble with the law or indeed spilled acid on a particularly sensitive part of their anatomy. But I'm sure most of us have a story of doing something stupid in the laboratory or, you know, in the course of our work. So if you do have stories you would like to share for the general gaiety of the nation and the world, please do send us in. Email address is pwld@iopublishing.org.
Yeah, that would be great if people could send things in. And you know, I think I can almost feel a tradition coming on here. You know, I was thinking when I read your piece that you know, maybe the April Fool's joke has sort of seen its day on Physics World, and you know, maybe this would be a better way to celebrate the 1st of April. But we shall see for next year. And of course, we can't do it unless physicists do stupid things and then tell us about it. So yeah, definitely please write in and tell us what you've done. And yeah, if you need cheering up in these sort of somber times, check out Margaret's article, Physicists Do Stupid Things. And that's on the Physics World website. Thanks, Margaret.
Cheers.
I'm afraid that's all for this week's podcast. Thanks to Carol Mundell, Margaret Harris, and Michael Banks for joining me. And a special thank you to our producer, Callum Jelf. And remember, if you like what you hear, then you can subscribe to the podcast via Apple Podcasts or your chosen podcast app. We're also on Spotify, so you can follow us there. Thank you for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.